Welcome to the Phoenix Unlimited Podcast.
How's it going, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to a new episode of the Phoenix MMA Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. This episode titled, You Play Basketball, You Don't Play Fighting. Just catchy title. I'll pick on basketball every so often because of the flopping in the sport. Basketball's not all terrible. The rule set is going to dictate the way that you play the game. And if you incentivize penalties, people are going to flop, just like in soccer. So if you love basketball, please don't hate me. Basketball's not the end of the world. But there is a point to the topic. You play basketball, but you don't play fighting. What we're getting to, it's just how serious. If you're going to be a fighter, and this podcast is specifically for our kickboxing athletes or Muay Thai athletes, boxing athletes, MMA fighters, MMA athletes. So the people that are going to get struck in the head, they're going to get punched, kicked, elbowed, kneed in the head and the face. This one's going to be specifically for you. If you're a grappler or if you're just doing this as a fun hobby, this is still a good, interesting, I'm going to try to make it a good, interesting listen. And so you could still learn something from it. But if you're saying, hey, I'm not interested in something in the context for an MMA fighter or a kickboxer, Muay Thai fighter, then you can skip this one. But one of the main reasons why I do this podcast is so that I can scale my teaching. So there will be plenty of times where I'll have conversations in the gym, and there will be really good questions that are asked about the program or coaching or teaching or competing. And I just can't, multiply the same conversation 1,000 times, 5,000 times. But with the podcast, I can do that. I can multiply it 10,000 times. As many people as want to listen to it can listen to it. So this one's going to be a little bit of like underwriting or how the coaching program, like a good coaching program, goes. Obviously, I'm going to try to keep this concise. Not going to be as long as the last, the active shooter, the school shooter podcast, obviously. But I'm going to try to be more concise with this one. And I'll just touch on a couple key points of the coaching program, what we do at Phoenix MMA, and some of the underpinnings to it, how it's working. So one of our fighters asked me a question early in the week. It was a good question, and like I said, it's a good thing to be able to put out so other people can hear it and they can understand what's going on, because I can see how there can be confusion, because things are everything I've done in my life, everything is way more complicated than it initially seems. It's just once you get into it, it's overwhelming, actually. If you realize how complicated it is when you're on your first day, you might not even keep going. But year after year, as you get in, it gets deeper and deeper. But it's one of the reasons why it's fun, continues to be fun and challenging. So sometimes it's very fatiguing. Actually, lots of times it's very fatiguing. It's difficult. It's stressful. Causes anxiety, frustration, but also a lot of joy and excitement and a sense of accomplishment and happiness. So that's what keeps me going. So the mix of both, so the good and the bad. So going to go over this, hit a good topic. So if anybody else is wondering this, they can understand what's going on. And maybe if you're interested in coaching in the future, this will be some tips on how to, coaching tips as well. So that if you're training somebody, you're cornering somebody, you're coaching somebody, it can help you out. So, this podcast is really gonna, another point that I'm going to try to make is, our Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu program is really taking off, recently. It's really, really doing well. And our striking program, one of the fighters texted me and sent me a picture, and that's when we had a discussion. One of our fighters, and it was basically about our Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu program taking off and our striking program, or MMA, not going at the same rate. That's what basically it was about. So we're having some Jiu-Jitsu, some really big success when it comes to grappling, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So what's going on with striking or MMA? We're going to go over things like that. So some of those things. So one of the biggest things first to unpack with it is to understand with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is at the time, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu program time. And what I mean by time is time of training, like consistent practitioners. I'm going to go over their schedule training later on, but right now it's not a surprise. All like your input, what you put in, is going to directly reflect your output. I'll go over training schedule and stuff like that, and it'll make more sense. It's pretty common sense, honestly, but time is a big component, and time and consistency are the biggest components, really. And they're the most simple indicator and thing that's going to explain with why the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu program is doing so well. We have a lot of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu students that have been putting the time in. They've just put years and years and years. We still are building. We have several strikers that have put years in, but we don't have as many strikers, Muay Thai, or MMA fighters that have put in the same amount of time that the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu students and athletes have put in. And I mean like consistent time, like training, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 3 years straight, 4 years straight, 5 years straight. What we're having, and this is all gyms have this same issue with MMA fighters and kickboxing and jiu-jitsu as well. The difference with jiu-jitsu is just lots of times people decide to do MMA because they actually want to fight and they want to maybe be professional. And lots of times those are young males and females, but especially young males. And they have no idea. I hear it all the time where they think they're going to come in, they're going to be amazing, and they think they're going to be professional and Conor McGregor next year. And they come in and then they realize very quickly they're not amazing. They're not amazing. They're not beating everybody. And they realize that in a year, not only they're not going to be professional, but they're not even going to be a top tier amateur after a year. And so what happens is with lots of young males, and it's just part of the life cycle. You're in a bit of a chaotic state in your life when it comes to just everything, just life, because you're young, and you bounce around from different sport to sport or gym to gym, and you'll just never get any traction that way, and you'll never actually really get good. You got to be able to stick somewhere 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years to really get something, to get a really big accomplishment. If you move or you bounce every 6 months to a year, you just can't get any traction going. I was actually talking to one of our jiu-jitsu athletes earlier in the week, and there's more gyms that are opening up where we are located. Luckily, just the way that we structure our business, it's not really a stress because we're nearly at max capacity. So our issue is not having enough students. Our issue is actually that we're at max capacity. Our issue is, and it's okay that we're max capacity. We are good. There are some programs that we have space still to grow. But now our issue is not getting new students. It's maintaining a good culture, maintaining a good training atmosphere, fixing the people that have attitudes or issues, fixing those, controlling the egos, keeping people motivated. Now we have a good functioning program. Now we need to focus. Now we need to maintain and improve internally. And then also, as we have openings, allow good new training partners to come in. What I mean by good is you could be super talented, you could be awesome, but you could still be terrible if you're just egotistical and you're just rude to everybody. It's like, we don't want you in the gym. If you have somebody super talented and they're easy to get along with, it's like, that's your George St. Pierre. This is awesome. That's your, whatever, if you several good fighters that go in that. I lost my train there. Started going on a rant. Sorry, I'm going to try to keep this one short and not rant too much. But that's what it was. Jiu-jitsu athlete was talking about that with different gyms and talking about things and was asking about what I thought about poaching, like gym poaching, like finding good athletes. And there are good athletes. Honestly, if it was... What I said, and I actually think this, I actually do believe this, that Now, and it's easy for me to say because the gym's nearly at max capacity, but even if somebody, and I've had this before, but if somebody came to me and they said, hey, and they were talented, they were good, and they said, hey, I want to leave my coach or I want to leave my gym to come to yours, like, hey, what are you going to do for me? Like, not only am I not going to do anything for you, but I don't even necessarily want that person. Like, I don't want to poach. If they have an issue where they need to separate, where it just is not working, that's not a problem. But if you're willing to, like, go behind your coach's back and do stuff like that, it's like, you will end up being like a cancer to the gym, and you'll come in and you'll just have a bad attitude, and a bad attitude can bleed off and cause other people to have a bad attitude, definitely. But also what it will do is it will run off people that have a good attitude, because, you know, if you're ever in a restaurant or you're in a place and one person is being rude or something like that, you don't necessarily confront them because it's just not necessary. You just get away from that. So it's like if you go to a grocery store and all the customers there are, just rude or just not it's not a good grocery store, you just don't go to that grocery store anymore. So what happens is the people with good attitudes basically just avoid the people with bad attitudes and they cluster together. So, yeah, little rant on the, a little sidetracked on the crionche, the old, jiu-jitsu term for, like a gym trader or team, whatever. If a program's not working for you, I don't have an issue. If a program's not working for you, a gym's not working for you, going to another gym and training. I also don't have an issue with cross training at all. They need a cross training. If your coaching staff is not working correctly for you or something like that, or even if just the commute is just not reasonable, it's understandable to find a different gym or a different trainer. But my point is that if you bounce around every 3 months or 6 months or every year, you're just never going to get traction. It takes years to build up a coach, fighter, student relationship. It takes years to build up good training partners. I said it yesterday, but it's like two of our guys, we had Zach and Kale, and they've known each other a long time, I think since like middle school or high school, roommates in college football. But yeah, they were going with each other, and they turned up the intensity. They both came like limping off after the round. As quoting, it's like, so you got Gordon Ryan, who's the best jiu-jitsu practitioner right now. And in an interview, he was saying his issue that he has right now is actually just finding good training partners, people that aren't going to injure him. And you would think, hey, why is the best jiu-jitsu practitioner in the world worried about getting injured? And it's not actually from a submission or getting dominated or actually beaten. It's somebody jumping on your knee, jumping on your ankle, eye gouging you, elbowing you in the back of the head or something like that, just off some being spazzy and not actually being good, just being spazzy. So I was making a little joke yesterday, but that's the goal is we're trying to get to the point in the gym where everybody's very competitive, but everybody's very technical, where we're going to get better, but limit the amount of injuries. Time. So that's a huge component for the jiu-jitsu program. The people that you're seeing that are having a lot of success is they've put a lot of time in. They're not training for 2 months, taking 2 months off, training for a month, taking a month off, moving cities, moving states all the time. Again, you have to live your life. Understand. It's just understand that if you are moving like that, without stability, you actually need to be a really good fighter. You need like this mixture of being a monk and a Spartan mixed together. And it's actually like it's a pretty boring lifestyle. It's a pretty boring, you're not drinking, you're not smoking, you're not going out to clubs, you're not partying, you're not going out to bars. You go to the gym, you go to work, you go home, you eat, you sleep, and you repeat every single day. It's actually a pretty boring lifestyle for normal people. So this is just for the fighters. This podcast is focused. Next thing that I'll say, that jiu-jitsu practitioners, the ones that are having success, they're following the program. So they are showing up and following the lesson plan. They're drilling, they're showing up to class, they're completing the class start to finish. They're not leaving halfway through it. They're not showing up 20 minutes late. That's a given. That's easy. It's you're paying your coaches to teach you, so should probably follow the program, follow the lesson plan. obviously you're going to train things yourself as well, and you're going to have your own style, but you can't learn from a teacher if you don't do what the teacher is teaching you. They do extra work. Extra work might be going to Spring Hill on Sundays, doing, you know, the open mat there. With striking, the same thing is available. There are multiple locations that have good open sparring sessions that people can go spar if they're looking for different looks or different opponents. So that's available for striking and MMA, exactly the same as it is for jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu, the main spot is going to be our sister school and Tennessee Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy in Spring Hill, Tennessee. If you're wanting to strike, just talk to me. And yeah, there's several open gyms, open mats on Saturdays and Sundays that are available that you can go to. And yeah, just let you know. The extra work, time, and following the program, those are the most simple, basic ones to follow. All the rest of this will just be extra things, extra details. One of our fighters, what's really got this idea for the podcast was one of our fighters texted me last week, sent a screenshot picture, and it was during one of our fights. And it was a picture of me and Eric, and we were in the corner coaching. And when you look at it, Eric has his phone, he's looking at his phone, and I'm standing up, and I think I have my hands in front of my face. Like, I think I'm, I think the post is actually blocking my face, but more than likely, if you could see the picture, I'm screaming like a madman, like a crazy person. And Eric's sitting there looking at his phone. So what's going on with that? That's what the fighter was asking. Why is Eric looking at his phone? Like, what's going on? So this is, you know, part of me, I'm like, sometimes it's actually, whatever, there can be miscommunications or misunderstandings, but the part of this is, will help with coaching as well. So what we're doing there is Eric's not looking at his phone or texting, or he's not on Facebook or on Instagram. Whenever we have fights, I take the lead with verbal commands. I'm the lead coach. Eric is the secondary coach. So what he does is he keeps time. He lets me know every 15 seconds and every 30-second increments so that I can call out time and dictate and adjust the lesson plan, or not lesson plan, but game plan or in-fight commands and tips. And then Eric is the secondary. He's keeping up with time, and then he's also looking for small details that I might be missing as well. As the lead coach, I'm being the lead voice, and I'm trying to give, my goal is to give guided advice on what to do in the next 5 to 15 seconds. So it's guidance reads off the opponent. Eric is the secondary, is picking up tendencies of the opponent. So he might be slipping in my ear, hey, the guy keeps dropping his right hand. The guy keeps dropping his right hand. He says that to me quietly while maintaining keeping up with time. He's giving me tips. I take that message, I internalize it, and then I process it and come up with a strategy. So if Eric's saying he keeps dropping his right hand, he keeps dropping his right hand, I will then give the fighter the command, left hook, give a throw a left hook. And that's because the fighter is dropping his right hand. And I might even repeat what Eric said. I might say, throw a left hook. He's dropping his right hand. I might repeat it. But obviously, it can be more detailed than that. It can be more complicated. Eric is the secondary, as being the more quiet coach. He's keeping up with time. That's why he has his phone out. And he's also giving me tips. As the lead coach, I'm the one that's screaming, losing my voice. Every single fight event, I lose my voice. Every tournament, I lose my voice. It's completely raspy and in pain after. So why do we do this? Okay. So when you are fighting, it's very difficult to take commands. You're just in a stressful situation. And the last thing you need is multiple voices, multiple tones, different volumes. Different voices are going to be hard to hone into, and different commands, that's going to be way worse. What you need when you're in a stressful situation is you need a loud, strong voice that's giving concise, consistent commands, tips, and advice. Okay. You're under so much stress and there's a crowd. If there's only one voice that you're locking onto, it's like you lock onto that tone. And you can hear, and out of all the crowd noise, you can hear that one tone. And if it's your coach, You're already accustomed to that voice anyway, and you lock into that. Even though you're getting punched, you could be laying on your back in guard and somebody's punching you in the face. But even while you're getting punched, the crowd's screaming, they're excited. You can still hear your coach's voice, like, but it needs to be one coach, not two or three coaches throwing commands or yelling commands. Then it just blurs. It's too much information. It's too much to process under stress. I'm naturally more loud. I talk more than Eric, so that's why I take the lead, and I'm the loud one because I yell. If you notice, I talk a lot, and I get loud, and I yell a lot. Eric is much more quiet. Eric's much more introverted than me, and Eric, we both are really analytical, but yeah, me and Eric, I mean, we'll debate on stuff for 2 hours about a technique. So we're both analytical, but Eric's just more of the quiet, more introverted. And I'm the louder one that that likes to yell. So I have no problem. So what you're going to do is with your leadership positions or your coaching positions is you put people in a position where they can win, where they can service the team the best as possible. That's why that I'm the lead. It's not even that I'm the head coach of the gym. It's actually, it's about a voice. It's about how loud it is. Eric's sitting there analyzing, and he doesn't have to worry about yelling. I'm actually giving more simple commands. Eric's analyzing during the fight more complicated than I am. I'm giving more simple commands, just as a louder. It's almost like he gives a more complicated, I filter it, and then I give more simple, analysis of what's going on and tips for the fighter. So if you ever see that, that's what's going on. And that's a good coaching staff. A bad coaching staff, this is what's funniest to the uninitiated or the amateur that doesn't know what's going on. If they have three coaches yelling in the corner going, get him, come on, go, get him, all right, this, hey, or let's say, I won't make fun of him, I won't straw man him, and I'll say, it's three coaches, and one saying, omoplata, underhook over on the side, left side, inside low kick, it's even worse if they're given really detailed, intricate commands, and there's three different coaches, because now the fighter's trying to process three complicated, pieces of advice from three different tones, voices, and speech patterns. It's just not good. So that's the purpose for that. Practice structure. Practice structure for our standard jiu-jitsu class and our standard Muay Thai class. The practice structure is primarily a skill-based, knowledge-based. So it's going to be a warm-up followed by skill drills and technical instruction. The jiu-jitsu class at the last portion has live rolling for the last 20 minutes or so, roughly. And that's just because for your normal student that is not trying to compete or fight, you can do about 20 minutes live rounds a day, and it's not going to wear you up. It's not going to wear down your body too much. You're still going to get some, little muscle pulls and things like that. But you can always opt out. The reason why the Muay Thai class is shorter than the Jiu-Jitsu class is because there's not sparring built into the class. The last 15 minutes is mitt work and pad work. But we have a dedicated sparring day for striking. With Jiu-Jitsu, you can, like I said, you can spar. You can go live roughly, 15, 20 minutes, 15 to 30 minutes a day. Even if you're just training 1 or 2 days a week, and be fine. You're not taking any brain trauma. When it comes to striking with Muay Thai, you have a dedicated sparring day, because that's something that everybody in the gym can organize their schedule to, all the fighters, everybody who wants to spar. And instead of it being atomized and people are sparring, some people spar on Mondays, some people spar on Sundays, some people spar on Wednesdays. People adjust their schedule and it's the water hole. Everybody comes together so they spar, so that you have different looks and different training partners. Obviously, the sparring day isn't always going to work for everybody's schedule. But like I said, there's also other sparring opportunities and cross-training opportunities as well. But again, this is for my hardcore fighters, athletes, students. This is... So if you're going to be a fighter and your goal is to be a professional fighter, you do organize your schedule around your life schedule, your work schedule. You organize it around your training schedule if that's your goal, is to be a professional. If your goal is not to be a professional, then no, you work or your profession is just something else. That comes first. Your gym schedule comes further down the line based on priorities. But yeah, the practice structure is a skill-based skill and technique for you to learn. And then the last portion is going to be mitt work, pad work. But the Muay Thai class is only an hour long, so that if somebody has, they have a tight schedule, family work schedule, they can come in, they can learn, they can get a good workout, and they can train for an hour. But if you're a fighter, yes, an hour is not going to be enough. If you're a fighter, 15 minutes of pad work is not going to be enough. You probably need about 45 minutes. That's why we have open gym time after. So the difference with jiu-jitsu is our jiu-jitsu athletes, the ones that are doing really well, are most of them are doing two or three practices or training sessions a day, 5 to 6 days a week. Now, those are the hardcores that are trying to be professional. Now, with our MMA fighters and our kickboxers right now, lots of them that want to fight, even that say they want to fight professionally, will come to class 1 day a week, and then they'll come to sparring. So that's two sessions. It's just not enough. Even when you're an amateur as a fighter, you have to train like a professional. Just so you know, every amateur fighter that does really well or wins an amateur title is training like a professional. It's one of the things that's really tough about being an amateur MMA fighter is you still have to work a full-time job. You still have a family relationship, but you still have to train like a full-time fighter. It's very difficult. It is a very difficult sport to do. There's no question. But with that being said, the Muay Thai class being an hour, if you wanted to get really good at Muay Thai or really good at boxing, you are going to have to put in extra work after class. It could be shadow sparring. It could be touch sparring. It could be mitt work. It could be body conditioning, leg conditioning. That's just a given. I would think that's kind of obvious, but there's tons of things you don't know it if you don't know it. So, sparring structure, if you're wondering about it, lots of times like this, this Thursday, we only did boxing rounds. And one of the newer students asked like, "Hey, are we not doing any kickboxing rounds, or why aren't we doing any kickboxing rounds?" So sparring doesn't mean that you just go in and act like a child and you just get to do whatever you want to do. Sparring should have a purpose. This is, I tell the jiu-jitsu athletes the exact same way, but every time that you do a sparring round, there should be a purpose. Every sparring day, there should be a purpose. It's not just you just go in and you just kind of wing it, see whatever's going to happen. There should be a purpose. For jiu-jitsu, an easy purpose is I want to get an arm bar. It's a really simple one. I want to get arm bars from every position possible. Then you can make it more focused where I want to get a triangle from a locked arm bar. And as you get more advanced, your strategies for practice, your goals should become more advanced as well. But as a beginner, you can start out really simple. So for striking, it could be I want to land a cross hook across to the head, left hook to the body or to the liver. And then it could become more advanced from there. But with the sparring, this is also another normal practice for good programs, and that will be some days you're doing inside boxing rounds, some days you're doing phone booth rounds, some days you're doing clinch rounds, some days you're doing kick sparring rounds, some days you're doing cat and mouse rounds, sometimes you're just doing open sparring rounds, but there should be an actual strategy. And right now what we need to work on with our striking program is really basic footwork, fundamental boxing, punches from boxing, fundamental parry, head movement, and blocks, slips, rolls, really basic fundamental boxing. So that's why I'm getting more boxing sparring right now, to upgrade the entire program's boxing skill. And then as our boxing skill improves, then you'll probably see us do more kick sparring rounds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the program will constantly rotate. But lots of times, if you just don't know, you just think like you just watch, if you don't have any experience, you just watch the UFC All Access or something like that, or a Rocky movie, You know, you'll think that you'll be, it'll just be full sparring every sparring session, but no, there's actual things that you need to work on. In jiu-jitsu, we call these situation rounds, wrestling called situation rounds as well, where like a bad program, a bad wrestling program, a bad jiu-jitsu program, yeah, they just, for jiu-jitsu, it's called rolling. So they just, all right, everybody shake hands and just roll, do whatever you want. And the reason why that's bad is because it doesn't force you to work on the areas that you're weak in or an area you might be good on it, but you need to improve it. Really important aspects of the sport, the combat sport that you need to work on. Lots of people don't like situation rounds because they just want to do whatever they want to do. But that's not the coach's job is not to let you do whatever you want to do. The coach's job is to make you as good as possible, as fast as possible. Refer back to that. And you got to follow the program. If you don't follow the program, you're not going to improve. Yeah, so that's a little quick explanation on sparring structure, on the reason why there are different types of rounds. Let's see. Put in here, fighters are, you know, about 5% of the gym, roughly 5 to 10% of the gym. That's just, if you're trying to be a fighter, this is awesome. You're taking on a really difficult challenge, really difficult task. But understand that you are a small percentage, and you're a small percentage of every single gym. What you're doing, it's because what you're doing is so hard. It's really hard to be an MMA fighter. It's really hard to step into a cage or in a ring and get punched in the head or kicked in the head. It's the reason for the title that you play basketball, you don't play fighting. Me as a coach, if you don't take it serious, I don't want to schedule you or get you a fight. I won't do it. It's unethical. Even jiu-jitsu, like you can go do a jiu-jitsu tournament. I don't want you to do it unprepared. But all you have to do if you get caught in an arm bar is you just tap. Your arm doesn't get broken. But that's not the case for a boxing bout, a kickboxing bout, or an MMA fight. If you're not prepared, then you can go to the emergency room and have a lot of lasting damage. If you prepare, MMA is actually not that dangerous of a sport. Some people will think that I'm crazy when I say that, but I would consider skateboarding and motocross more dangerous sports than MMA if you're prepared, if you're really good. Because you can always tap, verbally tap or physically tap from strikes in MMA. People forget that. But if you're prepared and you're in good shape, like your body is pretty armored up. Like you can take a full power punch to the face and it doesn't hurt that bad. You can take a kick to the body. It doesn't hurt that bad. You'd be surprised when people break their ribs or they break their jaw and they continue fighting. The combination of adrenaline and a really conditioned body, the human body's pretty cool when it gets when it's in fight shape. That's why I say if you're prepared, there's far more dangerous sports than MMA. But if you're not prepared, I don't want to get you a fight. It doesn't look good when the gym loses fights, but honestly, that's part of what's going to happen. We're going to lose fights. We are going to lose wrestling matches, jiu-jitsu tournaments or matches. That's going to happen. It's part of the process. I'm not going to be ashamed if you lose a match or if you lose a fight. It's just part of the game. You to get good, you are going to lose. But what I don't want is people to lose and when they're not preparing. Because for that's when it's embarrassing, is if somebody loses and they didn't prepare properly. That's when I feel bad as a coach that I let somebody fight if they didn't prepare. And that's why I don't want to do it. And that's why I won't do it. Yeah, we'll go to the next one. I think that's all I got. So, yeah, getting extra work after practice. This is another thing I said to the fighter was, it would be immediately apparent to me like, that somebody wanted to get really good at boxing or kickboxing. If after class, they were doing an extra 30 minutes of mitt work, and some people are on a time schedule. I understand you got to go. It's not a problem, but plenty of times people are just socializing. I'm also not against socializing after class or in the gym. The gym should be fun. It just means that if you're socializing, that then skill, getting good and being a good fighter or winning fights is not the number one priority. You can do both. It's just you have to put in the amount of work, and then it might be that you do an hour and a half of training and then 15 minutes of socializing. But if you do an hour of training and then 30 minutes of socializing, well, you spent half as much time socializing as you did training. So it's just again, input will give you your output, your result every time. Let's see. Yeah, you have to take it serious if you're going to be a fighter. If you want to be professional, you're going to have to take it. You're going to have to look at the sport. Even when you're an amateur, you're going to have to train like you're professional. You're going to have to act professional. Otherwise, you'll never become professional. It's not like you can show up just playing around and then out of nowhere be discovered. MMA is not... I'm nervous to say this because I would... not be surprised if singing's not the same way. I don't know if some people just have very naturally beautiful voices and they can just naturally sing. I'm just not educated enough on it. But I can tell you right now, MMA's not that. Like, no matter what you see on any promo videos or any fighters or anything, the hype-up stuff, there are no natural fighters. There are no natural MMA fighters. There are natural fighters, like somebody is more aggressive than somebody else, but not a naturally good MMA fighter. It requires way too much skill, way too much experience, way too much skill. You're not just going to accidentally fight in the UFC. It's going to take, from the start, you're going to have to behave like a professional when you're an amateur, as a beginner. And then after you do that for several years, then you're going to become professional. And then several years into that, then you're going to make your debut into the UFC. And then several years into that, then you're going to be in the top five looking for your title shot. That's just want to give realistic expectations. Going back more simple, you could, like, I can just give you my schedule that when I first started striking, because I came from a wrestling background and a Muay Thai kick, or sorry, wrestling background and a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu background, and then I went into boxing and Muay Thai kickboxing. When I went from wrestling first, then Jiu-Jitsu, then when I went from Jiu-Jitsu to boxing, when I really, really decided to focus on boxing, I dabbled in Muay Thai, like I would train, you know, one or two days a week. So this is what's funny. Like, I considered that dabbling, training one or two days a week as dabbling. Dabbling. That's not I hardly even count that as any of my training. But I got really, really serious about boxing and then kickboxing. And I was already a world champion in jiu-jitsu. That's when I got really, really serious. And when I went, first time I went into a boxing gym, it was refreshing because I was so bad at it. It was just exciting because I have something new that I can get good at. And I was really bad. But right away, I instantly just transferred the same thing I had done from wrestling, same thing I had done from jiu-jitsu, into boxing so that I'd get good at boxing. So my schedule, really simple, and it's a nice thing that you can do with striking that you can't do with grappling, you can't do with wrestling, you can't do with Brazilian jiu-jitsu, is my schedule 5 days a week. I did bag work, an hour bag work. Heavy bag, speed bag, double end bag. And even if you don't have those other bags, you can just get a heavy bag. I did an hour of heavy bag work 5 days a week. And then I went to practice to class 5 days a week. Out of one of those days was a sparring day. So 4 technical practices, 1 sparring day, and then 5 days of bag work. The bag work, that this is the advantage that you have when you're doing a striking sport versus a grappling sport, is bag work is a big part of the sport. There are only so many strikes. There are only so many combinations. It's obviously there are really crazy amounts of creative ways to develop or give every strike. and tactics, things like that. That's what you're going to learn in class. That's what you're going to be drilling in class and working on in class, or tactics and strategies and angles. But your bag work is to develop every single strike. So with my boxing coach, round one, lots of times round one was jab only. Single jab, double jab, triple jab, power jab, upper jab, jab to the body, jab to the head. Round two, and these are 3-minute rounds. Round two was just the cross, every type of cross. Then round three was lead hook. Round four was rear hook. Round five was lead uppercut. Round six was rear uppercut. Round seven would be speed to the body and then power to the head. And then the following round would be speed to the head, power to the body, et cetera, et cetera. But and there are more background options than that, obviously, but just a really basic overview. But an hour of bag work, think of just because you know how to throw a cross doesn't mean that you can throw a cross or throw a good cross. You have to throw hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of crosses to have a really good cross. The only way you can't do that on mitt work, because somebody has to hold pads for you. They have to hold mitts for you. And you can't do it sparring because you're not going to get that many rounds. Like, I have thousands of rounds sparring. But the way that you can get hundreds of thousands of reps of your cross or your lead hook is on the bag. It's also where you can develop power the best way, where you develop power on the heavy bag, not on your training partner's skull. The bag, you can be as heavy as you want. You're not going to cause a concussion. In sparring, we need to be smart so we don't cause concussions every sparring session. If you land five crosses on your training partner in a row while you're sparring, they might be hurt enough that you need to let them recover so they don't get a concussion. But the heavy bag in a round, you can throw 20 or 30 crosses. So it's just a numbers game, where to get to where under stress, where you can move like Israel Adesanya, that's millions of reps of striking. It's not thousands, it's millions. And that's where the bag work comes in. So that's how if you're going to throw a basic jab, cross, lead hook combination, how you get to that combination to where you have very little defensive liabilities, because as you're throwing each strike, your other hand is blocking your face and your chin's tucked and your shoulders are elevated where they need to be. The way that you, and then you can throw all three of those punches and it can land in less than a second or less than half a second, jab, cross, hook. The punches can land as fast as I can say it, jab, cross, hook, all three punches on the chin. The only way you can get that is you have to have thousands and thousands of reps on each individual strike, and then that combination thousands of times. And all skills depreciate over time. So if you take a few years off, then that the speed and the accuracy and everything's going to start depreciating on that combination. So bag work works for maintenance and developing. It tightens up all of your strikes, and it also works on maintenance for all your combinations. The class is teaching you reaction time, actual instruction of how to do the martial art and how to do the sport, angles. Pad work is the closest thing you can have to sparring without getting too much, accruing too much damage for yourself and your training partners. And then sparring should realistically be done once a week, one day a week, or once every other week, depending on how much damage you're taking. That's really, I guess, all of it. I was trying to only make it 30 minutes. We're at 43 minutes, so I apologize for being a bit windy, but trying to give some good instruction for our striking program for all of our fighters and all of our strikers that want to get as good as possible. Some little tips there. And our fighters, I want to see our fighters win amateur titles, and then I want to see our fighters win professional titles. And I do want fighters in the UFC. That's one of my bucket list things. I want a corner in the UFC. I want fighters in the UFC. What a coach is looking for lots of times is a good student. If you have a really good student, you know, obviously private lessons, paying for private lessons, you usually are going to have to pay for someone to do mitt work with you, pad work with you, or do explain things in depth outside of class. You're probably going to have to pay for a private lesson. But there is something that every coach is looking for, and that's a really good student. And if you're a really good student, you'll actually get free, kind of basically get free work, free private lessons from the coach. And I can explain that from being a coach. The reason why is teaching a class can get, you know, monotonous, or the same thing for a coach as well. They're teaching the basics year after year after year. And that's what, not complaining, that's what you sign up to do when you're becoming a coach. But from a coaching perspective, when you get a student who is receptive and will listen to you and will do what you tell them to do, or when they'll follow your lesson plan, it gives you this energizing effect. It's the reason why mentors will mentor people for free. It's because it gives that person who has been there before, like for me, to win, I've won a world championship, I've won two world championships. To win another world championship would be exciting, but it is way more exciting. It will be way more satisfying when one of my students wins a world championship. I will be happy to win another world championship, but it'll be 10 times more exciting and it just make me much happier for when one of my students wins a world championship. And that's just how it is. Like, until once you get it for yourself, you accomplish that, you achieve that. And now, it's more exciting to help somebody get to that point, 'cause you know how happy they will be for achieving it. And it's something that feels better than money. It's a, you know, if somebody could give you a bonus and you're like, hey, thank you so much, you know, thank you for the bonus, you know, you just won a UFC title. But the thing that feels better than the money, actually intrinsically feels better, is getting your student, getting your fighter to win something big like that. But the coach won't get that energizing effect if the fighter's student shows up once a week, twice a week. They don't do the lesson plan. The coach is teaching a lesson plan. They take time to come up with a lesson plan, and the athlete doesn't do it. What'll happen is the coach will just say, okay, I mean, you're just going to do your own thing. If you're going to do your own thing, that's fine. Do your own thing. But when you buy in and you're a really good student, the coach, you will make your coach want to be a better coach. They will want to help you more. Because it feels really cool. It's just this energizing effect. It could be somebody their first month in, but they are trying their best. And when I'm coaching or I'm teaching and they really, really put effort in, it instantly, wakes me up more. It feels it feels like a coffee. It's energizing. And the same thing happens for a pro fighter or somebody who wants to win a world championship or fight in the UFC. It's the exact same thing, but just on a larger scale. So yeah, that's my couple little tips and just a rant, I guess, on striking. A couple little tips to get our strikers on track and go over some things that I'd already talked to one of our fighters about early in the week, and I thought everybody else would benefit from hearing it. So hope you enjoyed this podcast episode, and hope you're having a good weekend. See everybody tomorrow, Monday, at the gym. See you.